from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Back near the dawn of the internet, a group of mostly young, mostly male kids gathered online to create a group they called the Cults of the Dead Cow, or CDC. Their attitude was punk, hence the song Teenage Kicks by the Undertones you're hearing now, but also idealistic. They're credited with coining the term hacktivism. Now a new book about the group has some people talking about its most famous alum, presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, who used to go by the handle Psychedelic Warlord. This hour we talk to journalist Joseph Menn about the group's origins, its legacy, and having a hacker run for president. That's next, right after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. I think we can agree by now that the internet is middle-aged, the province of established giants, megacorporations, and governments. The conversations we're having now are about responsible management and the limits of individual privacy and freedom. But some of those conversations were happening back in the day, and not just by journalists and academics, but kids with a knack for code and a blooming political awareness of the world around them. Today, we talked to some of the original hacktivists, the people indeed who coined the term, about the internet in the 1980s and 90s. And joining us to talk about this subject is journalist Joseph Menn, who just released a new book, The Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
So take us back to, you know, the interwebs before the World Wide Web, to dial-up modems. What was it like back then? What were you like back then?
Oh, let's see. I wasn't a programmer type. I only did that when I had to. I'm just an ordinary English major. These are people of my cohort. We're all Gen Xers. The original hackers were Gen Xers. Original in the sort of the. For the hackers that we think of today, and there are people that were hacking mainframes before, but these guys were the ones that had to struggle with a 300 baud modem to get online, and it sort of self-selected for people who were, you know, either desperate or very clever or both to connect to other folks.
You know, you get a sense of the aesthetic of this particular group you've profiled from the name Cult of the Dead Cow. Those of us in our 40s vaguely remember that far back. And then, of course, we grew up. Who were the members? Who were they back then, and who have they become since?
Well, it's an amazing group, and one of the things that I think has allowed them to last all the way to the present day is that they shared values, but they're very eclectic. They had a woman, which back in the day was awfully rare. But the original founders were in Texas, and they were bulletin board operators. Bulletin boards, for those of you much younger than me, were these sort of like online posting places where frequently only one person could connect at a time. I mean, it's incredibly archaic now, but
you had to use phone lines to get into this thing.
You had to use phone lines to get into this thing, and unless that bulletin board was in your area code, that led to phone bills on the order of hundreds and hundreds of dollars, which led to some unpleasant conversation with many people's parents. Which is why a lot of these people turned to crime, but they stole calling cards or credit card numbers or long-distance calling codes in order just to connect because it was so important to them. So a lot of them – it's funny. There are a lot of people today that are, you know, chief security officers or CTOs of Fortune 50 companies that all know that back in the day that they broke the law, and they know who each other are, and they never rat each other out like that. But everybody started that
way. Kind of agreed. It's sort of like, I guess, hot-wiring a car just to take it for a joyride.
Yes.
Yeah. So give us a sense back then. I mean, today, I guess now we think of blogs as old school, but a lot of what you were seeing back then were sort of the equivalent of news groups, people talking to each other and maybe sharing tips and tricks.
That's right. So a lot of it was, you know, helping their brethren and sistren to figure out how to connect. You know, it was sort of how-tos. This particular group, it was often very funny. I mean, so we're talking about 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds. And there is sort of this magical sort of bump in the demographics where if you came of age between the movie War Games coming out, which taught you how to war dial, and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act 3 years later in 1986, making a lot of what you would do illegal, you know, there are a lot of people that came online then and sort of had their eyes opened and then saw it all being taken away. And that made them think about even more about the establishment and whether, you know, people were misunderstanding what their intentions were. Because they're all, I mean, for the most part, pretty innocent kids.
Although there's that sort of wonderful adolescent hypocrisy in that they were breaking into systems and then getting angry, if you will, that companies like Microsoft had such easily breakable software. So it's like you shouldn't be producing or releasing software that we can crack so easily.
That's right. There's a lot of irony here. And they wrestled with that, you know, and I think it's one of the reasons that these people wound up being leading thinkers in security and setting a lot of the standards that people are still adhering to today, is that they had to make these sort of moral calls on the fly. Nowadays, cybersecurity is this nice, clean profession, and you can go to a nice college and go work for a big company and get a respectable salary and do cybersecurity things, but you're not like making these tricky calls all the time about, well, that's the law. Should I follow it or should I do something else? And, you know, what sort of access should I give others? It's these people were sort of have this moral forge that they operated in that's pretty much absent today.
Well, so talk about the idea of hacktivism. How would you define it?
So I think the most interesting definition is the one that the Cult of the Dead Cow came up with, which was security work in service of human rights. And a lot of thought went into that definition. And one of the sort of the biggest proponent of the idea within the Cult of the Dead Cow used the handle Oxblood Ruffin. And he had worked in the bowels of the UN as a consultant. And he knew that there are international treaties that included the right to information as a human right. And so when he was pushing the group to take this new direction, after it was already famous for embarrassing Microsoft, China was the first – the government of China was the first target because they were trying to censor the internet. And the CDC was actually a pretty big tent. There were people that worked for the government, the U.S. government. There were people that hated the U.S. government. But nobody liked what the government of China was doing. And so he really pushed them to take a sort of a broader political stand. And so they started working on things like a browser that would protect privacy, which is a live issue today. Because people are upset that the major commercial browsers are all about harvesting personal information and monetizing it, and it's all available to the governments if governments want access to it. So I think that is more interesting than a lot of the sort of the things we saw with the group Anonymous, where they would do denial of service attacks to shutter websites that they disagreed with, for example, PayPal and others that weren't processing donations to WikiLeaks. It's interesting, but it's not as, I think, sort of defensible as we're going to help people, you know, preserve their human rights.
You know, I think today we might be more comfortable with the different distinctions between white hat hacking and black hat hacking. But I imagine back in the day that, you know, a lot of people responded to a group with a name like Cult of the Dead Cow negatively at the first.
Well, it was a bit of a test. So first of all, when you're a 14-year-old boy, you need to be a little sinister. You can't be like Cult of the Wild Strawberry. You know, nobody's going to take you seriously. So they needed some of that sinister appeal. One of the interesting things is that, you know, all these people have agreed to come forward under their real names in the book for the first time. And so the founder is Kevin Wheeler, who went by Swamp Rat and then Grandmaster Rat. And he took a lot of marketing courses. And it's weird to think that marketing would be important to advance the cause of security or human rights. But it turned out to be very important. And they needed to seem a little sinister. They needed they're in early emails. He said, we need the straight press to think we're terrible, to think we're horrible. And they were delighted when there were editorials like condemning them because it was like rock and roll.
It was exactly what they were looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where does that name come from again?
So the Kevin and the earliest other guys were from Lubbock, Texas, and there was an abandoned slaughterhouse there that was kind of this creepy hangout. And when they, you know, sometimes they went there. And so it kind of fits because, you know, the iconic thing about Texas is cowboys and the cattle industry. And nobody really likes to talk about the slaughterhouse part of it. But that's what they were talking about. Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of like a rock band. You know, there have been different members over the years. Some have broken off and started their own rock bands, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's so it's a diverse group, like I said. And, you know, they peaked in fame 20 years ago. But since then, they've done all these different things. One of them founded a company called Veracode, which for the first time allowed big software buyers to analyze what the binaries in the code were actually doing as opposed to what the source code thought it should be doing. Mudge went to DARPA and created something called the Cyber Fast Track. So DARPA are the folks that brought us the internet. It's the Defense Department. They have the greatest slogan ever. It's the creation. Their mission is the creation and suppression of strategic surprise. But normally it's big companies or big universities getting big grants. And Mudge came up with a system where like ones or two, one hacker or two with a really cool idea could get a little money. And so it was for the first time, if you wanted to help the U.S. government, there's a way to do that without being a giant company or dealing with a bureaucracy. So they did all these different things. And then one of them decided to run for president.
Exactly. The most famous of them all. So tell us about Beto O'Rourke. My sense from this book is that he wasn't so heavily into the code as he was the community.
Right. And back then, that wasn't so unusual. So Beto was one of the first members. He's not a founder. He was one of the first members. He was from El Paso, Texas. And so he was one of those who had to borrow somebody else's long-distance service to connect. And that was wrong, but he was a miner. Back in the day, you know, I say it's like it was the liberal arts wing of the hacker underground. So there were more technically proficient hacker groups, most of which got busted up with arrests. The CDC survived because it wasn't about crime. They looked up to those people. They were sort of jealous of those people technologically. And so they wrote files that mocked them for being like too stuck up and snobby. And Beto was part of that. So he helped set the sort of the early sort of group mindset of the group. But then he punched out before they became really famous. And his handle was Psychedelic Warlord.
Which, yeah, it's a big name for a little guy at the time. I'd love to invite people to join us as we talk about the roots of hacktivism with Reuters investigative reporter Joe Menn and his book, Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. You can join us by calling 866-733-6786. Of course, with your parents' permission if you are a minor. 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, especially if you're a Gen Xer and you prefer email. That's forum@kqed.org. We are monitoring Facebook and Twitter, both of which came a little more recently. Tell me a little bit about that subtitle, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. Is there a way in which, you know, this history is still relevant today?
Oh, incredibly so. And that was one of my major motivations for writing it. So it's not just, I mean, security itself is incredibly complicated, involves all these difficult moral calls, and you know the quest for governments are always trying to get back doors, and that's a fight that's happening again now. The crypto wars, you know, Son of Beneath the Planet of the crypto wars we're on now, and people need to know the history. But beyond that, these people were critical thinkers, and they had a sense of moral mission. And if you look at big tech today, they are out of touch. Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon are all doing things that are angering their own employees because they're making calls that are about the bottom line. And those companies have lost touch with the sort of the roots of the early tech leaders and pioneers and free thinkers. And you know, some of the people inside those companies that are sort of pushing for human, you know, greater respect for human rights and other considerations, they either were in the Cult of the Dead Cow or they were mentored by people in the Cult of the Dead Cow. And particularly younger folks, I think, would be well served to know a bit of the history.
Well, speaking of history, you've got some of it on the phone line right now. Michael Kubeka, also known as Omega, is ready to roll. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Take us back. When did you join the group, and how old were you at the time?
Well, let's see. So, like many of my peers, the movie War Games got me into BBSing and the computer underground. I was about 13 or 14 at the time. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I'm going to stop you there, too, and do a little translation for the generations that came afterwards. First of all, tell me about the movie War Games.
Oh, sure. So the premise of War Games is that a lone student with a computer and a modem who's dialing phone numbers at random, trying to find a software company to download a particular game, stumbles on a military computer. While exploring this military computer, starts to set off red flags about a war game, basically, and kind of gets the United States government worked up over what it perceives as an attack.
And then I'm going to follow that up with another basic question. What is BBXing?
So BBSs were kind of like the Facebook or the Slack of their day. So you would set up a computer with a modem and a dedicated phone line, and one person at a time could call into this BBS, and there would be forums dedicated to particular topics. It could be mundane things like school or friends, or they could be esoteric things like hacking into computers or being able to make free phone calls. So as these BBSs arose in the 80s, you found different BBSs that you wanted to call. And so they developed these followings. And, as I said, some of these BBSs were more above board, and some BBSs were sort of part of the computer underground.
And, you know, Joe was mentioning earlier that it's only with the publication of this book that a lot of people have been outed, so to speak, including Beto O'Rourke. I'm curious, you know, why was the group willing to sort of desiring to keep their involvement quiet, the folks who have, gone on to do other things, not just be political candidates?
So when we learned that when you brag about your exploits or you lose control of your pseudonymity, it often resulted in unwanted attention. So this is a mistake that I and others saw others make as we were first starting out. So this is sort of just to sort of protect ourselves and insulate ourselves from unwanted attention. Came up with pseudonyms for ourselves, and we closely guarded our identities. Secondly, sort of as recently as the 2000s, computer companies didn't hire hackers. Now, this was before computer security curricula were widespread. So where did these security consultants come from? Well, apparently they were grown in a lab, born into a state of grace of some kind. At least that's what they told journalists and especially investors. And when some of these hackers were publicly exposed as having these checkered pasts, many of them were fired. So, that is a concern that many of us who are still in the computer security industry have worried about for a long, long time.
Joe, is he describing something that you recognize?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, certainly of a certain age, if you go far, there are no really, really good security people I know of. Like I'd say like 40 or older who did not do something illicit at some point. I mean, that's how you go exploring, and it's what makes them critical thinkers. So it's I think there are younger people now that have been clean all the way. But, back in the day, no, there isn't anybody that I think is really terrific that didn't do something wrong.
Now, Omega, I know Beto O'Rourke has gotten in trouble for some of his writing revealed in this book. Is there anything you did back in the day with the CDC that you either regret now or it just makes you blush?
Let's just say that I was a curious kid with a computer.
Good answer. Omega, thank you so much for joining us. I know you can't
thank
stay
you.
With us the whole hour, but what a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that, again, is Michael Kubeka. Joe, I'm wondering, speaking of exploits, if you can sort of describe using the plainest English possible one of the most famous exploits of the group, Back Orifice.
Yeah, sure. So if I could just do a super quick history here. So the CDC, one of their earliest members was a guy named Jesse Dryden, son of Spencer Dryden of the Jefferson Airplane. And he founded the first hacker conference that invited the press and the cops. Previously, cops were just showing up undercover. And that was called HoHoCon, started in 1990. And that brought in people with sort of greater technological expertise, people, among other places, from The Loft, a famous Boston hacker space. And this included people like Mudge. And so before, you know, as one of the co-founders who started fading away told me, CDC sort of became the people that they had been making fun of. They got this hardcore talent. And then around the same time, Microsoft decided to bundle the internet into Windows. They put in TCP IP into Windows 95. And it was great that people could get access to the internet, but there was basically no additional security. So it was suddenly what had been the concern of a small number of business folks who use software became everybody's concern. And the CDC didn't have any leverage. It didn't have any way to force Microsoft to take security more seriously. So they thought about it, and they called upon their sort of marketing acumen and their sort of the performance art aspect to what they did. And they decided to make the biggest spectacle possible and see if they could get on TV and embarrass the monopoly Microsoft into doing the right thing. And so at DEF CON, the great successor to HoHoCon, in Las Vegas, they took the stage in costume with Kevin Wheeler wore rabbit fur chaps and a cowboy hat and gold jewelry and led the crowd in a call and response. And this is 1998. And threw out CDs into the crowd that contained Back Orifice, which was a Trojan that allowed pretty much any script kiddie to take control of somebody else's Windows machine if they could just get them to click on one thing. And the philosophy behind it was that serious bad guys could already do that. And Microsoft wasn't moving off the dime. So if they get on TV and say, yeah, and they pretended to be terrible people, you know, now anybody can go get Microsoft, that would force them to get better. And over time, it worked.
I remember back in the day when I was working at an internet service provider in tech support that we talked about Microsoft software being like Swiss cheese, holes you could drive a Mack truck through. And indeed, when you say Trojan, you're talking about a Trojan horse, holes you could drive a Trojan horse through. I want to make sure that our audience knows we are welcoming your calls this hour. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786 to talk to Joe Men, whose new book is Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. And now that you're at the ready with your smartphone, what is that? 866-733-6786. You can email us, of course. We're forum at kqed.org. Head to Facebook, head to Twitter. We're watching all of those channels. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny, and we're talking about the roots of hacktivism with Reuters reporter Joe Men. His book is Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. And we're already getting calls and comments. Will tweets, Moo, reference to dead cow, for those of you who are a little confused. Their tools were fun to play with in the late 90s before the internet got super commercial and before most people ran firewalls and NATs, referring to network address translation. I'll just leave it there. As we head to a phone call, let's talk to Deepa in Palo Alto. Hi, Deepa.
Yeah. How's it going? Thanks so much for doing this segment. I have one question for you. Mm-hmm. Joe had mentioned earlier in this conversation that there are a lot of individuals who are at these companies, whether it be Amazon or Facebook or what have you, that are upset by the fact that they are behind the times in terms of prioritizing human rights. However, as one such individual who actually ended up leaving Silicon Valley for a brief period to go to MBA school, I've noticed that there aren't a lot of companies, even coming out of it in 2019, that are looking to hire people who want to work on human rights activism within the tech sector, especially when it comes to identity and security. So I'm curious as to what the thoughts are for young people who are looking to make a living while also working on this.
So that's a good question. So there are opportunities within those companies. There might not be as much as others would like, but one nice thing that's happened is that a lot of the nonprofits out there are hiring their own technologists now. They're the obvious places like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU. But, you know, Doctors Without Borders needs secure communications, and, you know, so do many other multinational groups. So there are very good things to be done in the nonprofit sector. And then, congressional staff now includes actual technologists, which is something that didn't used to be the case. So there's all kinds of opportunities for public sector work. One of the points I make in the book is that there should be this sort of tradition of public service, like there is in law and medicine. You know, pro bono is taken as a given. The companies could do a lot more to facilitate that. They could allow leaves. You know, take a year and go work for a charity and then come back. Your job is safe, something like that. They could certainly afford to do things like that.
They certainly could. You know, one of the interesting things I found in this book is that a lot of cult members, even as wee babes, predicted some of the things that we are experiencing today.
They did. They saw a lot of this coming. As I said, their sort of peak of fame was 20 years ago. But it to me, some of the most impressive things that they've done is after that, when the spotlight went away and they did things in the public sector and in government, in sort of in the bowels of these companies, and by training others in sort of thinking about these moral issues who then went inside these companies.
Let's take another call and go to Anita in Saratoga. Hi, Anita.
Yes, hi. Hi. I just want to thank you for the call for this program, and I want to ask the author what the CDC is working on next. But I also want to confess, this is the first time I've ever said this in public. I have stolen phone cards before, and I never knew I had
dear.
A peer group. Thank you. I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you, Anita. Thank you for sharing that little revelation there.
So what is the CDC doing now? Well, some of them have been doing fundraisers for Beto O'Rourke and working on his campaign, at least part of the time. It's funny. So some of the people in these groups are now super rich because, you know, they're, you know, first of all, it's an extremely smart group of individuals. And those who went into the public sector, some of them have companies that are now valued in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So they have sort of increasingly engaged in electoral politics. Others that they have trained are sort of helping with cybersecurity around campaigns. There was like 2016 was very painful for a lot of people in Silicon Valley. People who worked at Google and Facebook and thought they were doing good saw that their platforms were being manipulated. And that was very upsetting to sort of not see yourself as part of the good guys. And I think for security people, there was also that sort of painful recognition. And so a lot of people are working on things like that. There's one, Alex Demos of Facebook was not in the Cult of the Dead Cow, but he admired them, and he worked for them at Stake, which was a sort of boutique security consultancy in the early 00s that was very important. Inside Facebook, he was the one that blew the whistle on Russian disinformation. So the CDC influence goes on in a lot of places. They helped with the development of Tor by sort of being friendly competition to Tor.
Remind us what Tor is.
Oh, sorry. Tor stands for the Onion Router, and it's one of the principal anonymity tools that Edward Snowden endorsed. It's complicated, but it's a way of communicating without revealing who you are when you're browsing the web. The CDC also had some influence on an outfit called the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, which researches and publishes reports about how governments use spyware against their own citizens.
Well, we have another cult celebrity joining us now, Mudge, a.k.a. Peter Zatko. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
So have you had a chance to read Joe's book?
I did. I just finished it not too long ago.
And what's your thought? Is it a fair representation, or are there any corrections you'd like to make on air now?
Well, first off, Joe did like a really Herculean job because this is 20 years ago. There's a lot of characters. There's a lot of different history with a lot of different perspectives. And, you know, I disagree with parts of it, but the parts I disagree with are relatively minor. And I think as a whole, he really captured it. And he did a good job. And I have to respect the amount of work that went into it. And I talked to him about the book about 2 years ago. So I think it took him, you know, that entire time to get that much access and that much information.
How did you get involved in the cult?
They happened with most of the characters except for one, recruited me. They came and said, hey, we'd like you to be a member. What do you think? And I'd known them for years. You know, we all kind of hung out in the same online circles. Occasionally we'd meet in person at, like, you know, the conferences, HoHoCon out in Texas, early 90s. And what they were looking for when they approached me was they were doing more kind of social and creative writing and expressive posts with commentary, and they wanted to get into more of the sort of heavier technical side. And so they said, you're the person we know on that. Can you create some, you know, technical articles or tools or stuff and give it to the cult, that we can, you know, release under our banner to give ourselves a bit more technical legitimacy in addition to the kind of overall social effort and social awareness that they had.
And what's the exploit you're most proud of, looking back on it now?
It's hard to say. I'm considered kind of like the grandfather, or at least the crazy uncle, of a lot of the common attacks and technologies that are in use today. So buffer overflows, I was one of the first people who inspired and detailed and shared how that works. And that's a common attack vector that is still used in most of the what they call zero days exploits that, you know, there's no defense for yet because it's brand new. Timing attacks, race conditions, object reuse. It was kind of fundamental technologies that I came up with or that I at least explored early, shared how it was done, and then Fields grew up refining it. Much more technically involved than I ever got in any of those particular areas, but I opened the doors.
Well, what do you make of some of the self-professed white hack hacking that we have seen since then? I know different people come down differently on everybody from Anonymous to Snowden to Assange.
Well, the whole phrase hacking is you know, a single moniker for such a wide range. I mean, ransomware gets termed as hacking. Ransomware is when, you know, somebody installs some piece of code on your system and it takes control and it won't give it back to you until you pay, you know, some sort of ransom. Keeping your system hostage, this has happened to cities, Baltimore, it's happened to...
It's happened to KQED.
KQED. And my book, that's not hacking. You know, that's simple extortion. That's simple crime. It's using some tools that are technology, but, you know, there are a bunch of other tools that are technology. Then you go to people who are doing it under a flag of, you know, a political statement. And sometimes it's, you know, disrupting communications to say, we disagree with this place, so we're not going to let them have a voice, which I find kind of, you know, a cognitive dissonance that, you know, you want to have a free voice, but you choose to use it to stop somebody else from having their free voice. And then you get like kind of the researchers. And I always came with the researchers. I was, you know, a tool creator. And a lot of the other folks in the field were tool users. And that particular situation gave me a lot of access because the tool creators were highly valued, especially ones that would share it with people.
One last question for you, Mudge. Was there anything in the book that surprised you where you thought, oh, gosh, I didn't know about that?
Well, I got to get a little more backstory on some of my friends and colleagues that, you know, I didn't know. We didn't really talk about personal lives or, you know, how they met or some of the social situations. And that was kind of fun reading. I did kind of chuckle that Joseph really wanted to say, like, you know, Mudge must have done something criminal. He must have done something illegal. Everybody was doing it. And it's one of the things that I really didn't do. I didn't have to. I worked at BBN Technologies, which was the company that invented the technology for the Internet under a DARPA grant, which I later went and worked for there. So I had 100,000 systems at my disposal that I could break into and do what I wanted with. And when I ran the loft, I put the hammer down and said, we only do things on our own systems, not just because, Electronic Communications and Privacy Act and other computer laws were coming out, but for the scientific method, I wanted to be able to research and explore things in a controlled environment where I knew that my cause was the cause of the effect that I'm observing. So I did chuckle because, he went after that quite a bit, and, maybe there's something. I did some underage drinking, so maybe that makes you happy.
Coming clean about it here on KQED. Well, Peter Zatko, a.k.a. Mudge, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye, Joe.
Greg tweets, the CDC folks I met at DEF CON 5 inspired me to move to California when I was 19. The friends I made from the cult and its associated community have been lifelong friends. The importance of this group goes beyond hacking. I suppose, Joe, I want to ask, as you dug into the reporting for this book, were there big surprises for you?
Well, sure. When I started, I knew that there was – when I committed to write the book, I knew that there was a congressperson. actually, I knew it was a man. I knew there was a guy in Congress who had been CDC. And the people within the group who were talking to me said, yeah, he's never spoken about it publicly. I doubt he's going to. I'm like, well, boy, that's a challenge. Once I started writing in earnest – clearly that was going to be one of my missions, to figure out who it was and try and convince them to talk to me. And as it happened, I saw an article from somebody who was running for Senate in Texas, which is the birthplace of CDC, and this person had been in a punk band and had run a software company. I'm like, whoa. And was the right age. He was like in early 40s. And I'm like, okay, this really seems like it's it. And then my people in CDC wouldn't say yes or no because they were worried about messing up his campaign. It's hard to explain, certainly in a soundbite. and so that was I said, look, the book isn't going to come out until after November. I promise I won't reveal it before then because there's no other way I was going to get the information. And they said, really? And I said, really? And I said, okay, yeah, it's Beto O'Rourke, and we're super proud of him. So that was a surprise. And then Beto agreeing to speak to me on the record, also under embargo, was awesome. It was a great interview, and he explained how they were the cool kids, and he wanted to be like them, and why critical thinking and outsider thinking is very valuable, which I agree with. So that was all kind of miraculous. And then, I knew he was a long shot for Senate. I held the book. We didn't want to go to press until we knew what the last line of the book was going to be. They lost for Senate. I'm like, okay, so we send the book in. It's in production. And then, wait a minute, he's driving around these other states talking to people. He doesn't seem like he's going away. So the fact that one of the characters decided to run for president, near the end of the book was, I'd say that was a surprise.
Randy tweets, somewhere I still have a Cult of the Dead Cow t-shirt. We're taking your calls at 866-733-6786. And with that, let's go to Dan in Santa Clara.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest is, with his experience, you should know fairly well how safe information is online. Take my 18-year-old son who went down to apply for an Amazon job. He had to spit into a little container, 23andMe style, to do a drug test background. They have his DNA. How long will that be there? How secure is that? Thank you.
So I think the online the DNA stuff in particular is interesting and dangerous. So there have already been criminal cases solved because a relative submitted their genes for testing. This is a rapidly developing field. Like other sort of biometrics, it's very scary from a surveillance standpoint. But this is great. It's good when unsolved murders get solved. Is that stuff – is your personal genetic blueprint protected sufficiently? I doubt it. I don't think anything's protected sufficiently. But I think it's important not to be absolutist on this stuff. There are real trade-offs that need you know, serious conversation. And one of my frustrations covering cybersecurity for 20 years is that there is overclassification in the government level. And because there's complexity, there isn't enough serious conversation. And that was another of my goals in writing about this group.
That was a question I wanted to ask you. You know, there have been a lot of conversations going on in Sacramento and Washington, D.C. about how to step back in and start regulating some stuff that has gone essentially unregulated for years, if not decades. But it's a little frightening when you sometimes see people either politicizing the conversation instead of talking about regulation as an absolute good for the greatest number of people. And it's a little frightening sometimes when you sense the lack of technological sophistication on the part of some lawmakers.
So it's getting better in Congress. You have people with some technical backgrounds, some intelligence backgrounds. It is still not where it should be. I think that some of the conversations are too blunt and simplistic, but that's true of everything political, right? I think a lot of this stuff doesn't do well as a soundbite, but I think at least it is sort of forcing a conversation that is well overdue. And I don't think very few people anticipated that, you know, the free speech conversation would turn out to have this sort of stepchild where we talk about overwhelming, noisy speech, you know, being propagated for political and purposes. And so that's a real live issue where it's not that Facebook is preventing you from saying something. It's that you're drowned out by these organized disinformation campaigns, domestic and foreign. And that's complicated. This is really complicated stuff.
You probably saw in the New York Times that for the last 3 months, the most popular Joe Biden website is one designed by a Trump campaign operative. And this also gets into the politicization of this conversation, not just in the U.S., but internationally as well.
So parody is fair. And it's natural to parody something that you disagree with politically. So you could say, well, you know, at a, you know, 30,000 foot level, gosh, it's bad if people looking for information about Joe Biden go first to a site that is sort of secretly anti-Biden. On the other hand, how the heck would you design a rule? I guess I could see something about, similar to the requirement that you have to say paid for by, you know, some PAC or some political group on political advertisements. But, you know, you get down to the fine print and, you know, how big is the font on that kind of a disclosure? And that doesn't really apply to most search engines. So it's like the obscenity thing. You can, you know, it when you see it. But gosh, you don't want ham-handed rules around this stuff.
James writes, I hacked the U.S. Treasury in 1982, pled guilty in 84, and helped the FBI create a profile of hackers as part of my sentencing agreement. Now, this included, see how many of you feel like this describes you. Number one, male, 20s, early 30s. Number two, master of the universe mentality, keepers of great secret power. Number three, because it's there, the same challenge of mountain climbing, triathlon, game scoring. Number four, invincibility, thinking no layman can keep up or catch up. Number five, James Bond of computing, attracted by the glamour of secret achievements. Does that sound about right to you, Joe?
Yeah. For the folks that went over the line, maybe stayed over the line too often, that's a pretty good thumbnail profile. I would say that the CDC guys and a lot of other people think of themselves more along the lines of early text file by a guy who called himself The Mentor. And he wrote a text file called The Conscience of a Hacker. And basically the tenets there were hacking is about exploring. It's about gaining knowledge. It's not about destruction and it's not about profit. I'm not saying that every hacker is a terrific person, has a terrific sense of sort of moral balance. But I will say, you know, in the communities that I've covered, most of them are good people. And of those, most of them think pretty rigorously about it. You know, how you know, because they've had to make tough calls. Because somebody's always going to ask them, "Hey, can you hack my ex-girlfriend?" Or, you know, "Can you I have access to something I shouldn't?" And they'd have to think about it carefully. And I think that's an admirable habit. And it would be great if, like, freshly minted MBAs and people with JDs who are coming out here to work in the Valley at big companies had that kind of rigorous moral battle every day.
Gary says we need more positive hacktivism to improve knowledge about crucial issues. Like many folks, I use several social media apps and see way too many fraudsters out there.
Yeah, well, that's going to continue. There's a lot of fraud. My previous book was about Russian organized cybercrime and its sort of alliance with Russian intelligence. I went over there, and crime just is just seen as another profession over there. It's not seen as that bad, and it's in part because the government is corrupt, and it's part because there is no Silicon Valley there. There are a few big tech companies, but what are you going to do with your expertise? You can do some engineering, some contract stuff, but you're not going to make a bajillion dollars like you can in theory in Silicon Valley. So crime scales really well on the internet. And frankly, the bad guys do capitalism better than we do. They invest in R&D. They diversify. They've got lots of specialization. It's a really impressive system. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is like that. The outlook is really actually pretty grim. And I wanted to call attention to some positive stuff because otherwise, why go to work in the morning if this is what you do for a living?
It does seem like the internet, for all that it's done to open the world, open people in the world to each other, what we've discovered is that the lowest common denominator gets to dominate a lot of the platforms, politically, technologically, even just in terms of conversation.
We have an emergency crisis in the lack of critical thinking. We have a record number of people who believe that the Earth is flat. We have science being denigrated, and people just generally not having a clue. And I don't think the U.S. Department of Education is going to parachute a bunch of philosophy professors into school districts around the country to explain evaluation of sources. So we need other ways to call out and salute critical thinking. I'm just trying to do my bit.
So let's imagine that I don't know if you have kids, but that you start Cult of the Dead Cow 2 in your basement. What would you tell those kids to go out and do?
So the bad news is, as cybersecurity and tech has compartmentalized and professionalized, there are people who know a lot about software that know nothing about hardware, and there are different, there are many, many subdivisions. And so it's sort of harder to have this sort of meeting of minds where people are coming from different backgrounds, and some of them, are English majors without any technical background. They just, are appreciating the social aspects or the political aspects of it. So it's harder to have this sort of gathering of different people. On the other hand, there are more opportunities to do good more easily. There are open source projects like Signal for secure communication and others that didn't exist before that also sort of rose up as part of hacktivism, as part of opposition to software monopolies and oligopolies, providing real alternatives. There are nonprofits to go work for. So there are more things to do. But one of the lessons is that a small group of people from diverse backgrounds with shared values can accomplish a tremendous amount. So go find that sort of commonality, where you have something in common with people that are different from you, and talk about how each of you sees the world and what you think could be done, and then find the people with real experience that are good teachers, because there are a lot of them out there that want to do the right thing.
That is one of the DIY ethos of the Cult of the Dead Cow is something that still resonates today. People helping each other, not necessarily push forward some kind of standardized agenda, but coming from a good place, a lot of good can be done.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now you mentioned years of research going into this book. Did you identify in the course of that research what the topic of your next book is?
So I turn out books at the clip of like once every 8 years or so. I did one on I did the definitive Napster book, and then I did the Russian organized crime one and then this one, but that's over 20 years. I have no interest in starting out on another book right now. I want people to find out about this one. And, you know, my day job is as an investigative reporter on technology. I'm doing stuff on artificial intelligence, which I think is interesting because it crosses similar boundaries. It's a tech story and a business story and a national security story and a geopolitical story. That makes it interesting, and there are interesting people around that. So that's the sort of thing I'm looking at now.
Artificial intelligence, it's where everything seems to be going.
A lot of it, yeah.
Well, Joe, what a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much. It's been great.
We've been talking with Reuters investigative reporter Joseph Menn. His book out now, go get it, Cult of the Dead Cow, How the Original Hacking Supergroup Might Just Save the World. You can continue the conversation online. We're at kqed.org/forum. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay with us. We've got more to come. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.